welcome. This is Rick Barton. I'm the co-director with Karen Von Hippel, who is here as well, of the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Project at CSIS, and we're very pleased to have our guests in Pakistan with us on the line for what will be another lively discussion in the series that we started last week with the pre-election conversation. I'm sure many of you who are here for that conversation really had a chance to see the value of it as you read the newspapers and follow the news over the weekend, that we really had a great preview of what was going to happen and what some of the issues were. And so it was. I think we're looking for the same kind of, not just review of what's happened the last couple of days, but sort of an anticipatory look as well from a couple of our guests, and a pretty good review of the election process and some of the challenges that still remain there from a couple of our other guests. We'd like to thank Plowshares and Carnegie and Soros for their help with hosting this series. I'd like to thank Mark Irvin and Vanessa Kulik, who you've all met here, who've really done this work with Malaka Sandani, who has been so helpful in rounding up our guests and in helping us think through the direction of this of these events. For those of you who have to leave early or want to be reminded of what was said here, this event will be posted on our blog, and both through the CSIS website and PCRproject.com right away. Plus, there will be later in the day a shorter version, maybe 5 and 10 minute clips that you can download as you walk home on your iPod or whatever, so that you'll be able to stay tuned to the discussion that we're holding today. The one request I'd make of our guests is that they be as concise as possible and they keep their remarks to the 5 to 7 minute range. This worked out very well last time. We were able to really have a discussion. Watch out for headphones and cell phones, if you would, there in Pakistan. Those do create a little bit of a static for us sometimes back here. And I think that we have one guest. Our first guest can only be with us for about 15 minutes. So what I will do is introduce all four of you, and then Nujum, if you could limit your remarks to that 5 to 7 minute zone, and then we'll be able to take maybe 3 or 4 questions for our first guest, and then we will go on to the other three guests and then have a second question and answer period with them. So, as you can see on the board here, that our three guests are Nujum Sethi, who's the editor of the Daily Times, a leading newspaper in Pakistan, and who's also the editor of the Friday Times, which is a popular weekly magazine. He's a political commentator, social activist, and he is with us from Lahore today. Then we have Ahmed Bilal Mehboob, who is the executive director of the Pakistan Institute of Legislative Development and Transparency, which is popularly referred to as PILDOT, and that's in Islamabad. And then Glenn Cowan, who is the co-founder and CEO of Democracy International, is also in Islamabad. He's an expert on democracy and governance, public opinion research, political organizing, and vote count verification. He's developed, is the inventor of the most sophisticated way of doing parallel vote counts in the world. And then back, by popular demand, is Stefan Darnoff, who is the country director for IFAS and was such a valuable contributor to our first discussion. And he's in Islamabad. So what we will do is, if we could, if Nujum, if you're still there, and we will start with you, and then we will sort of give you a 15-minute block, and then we will move to Ahmed for his comments as well. So thank you for being with us, and we're looking forward to your comments. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I was told I could talk for 10 minutes because I won't have an opportunity to come back again. So with your indulgence, here I go. Surprisingly, this has been a great election. It vindicates those who, like Benazir Bhutto, argued for a peaceful transition to democracy instead of a confrontation aimed at transformation. It supports the pollsters who said the country was awash with anti-Musharraf sentiment, and the PPP was the most popular party in the country, followed by the PMLN. The best part of the election is that the forces of religious extremism have been routed, and the true worth of moderate, mainstream, and even secular parties has been duly upheld. To give the devil his due, President Musharraf has shed his uniform and held credible elections like he promised. But it is not lost on us that he was shoved and pushed in that direction by a persistent civil society and a concerned international community. So what more could Pakistanis ask for? Well, plenty. With the tailwind behind them, Mr. Zardari and Mr. Sharif are demanding President Musharraf should quit. They say that the people have cast a vote of no confidence in him and he should respect their verdict. But Pakistan is not an established democracy, and General Musharraf is not a terribly, transparently, legitimately elected president, so he's refused to oblige. Where do we go from here? One option is to get back into confrontation mode, unite the anti-Musharraf forces in parliament, and try and impeach him or strip him of his extraordinary power. But that's easier said than done. Even a two-thirds majority in the National Assembly for a constitutional amendment won't do the job, because the Senate is still controlled by the PMLQ and is likely to be in that situation for another 2 years, until new elections are held. The other option is to boycott Parliament and take to the streets, provoking the armies to step in at some ugly stage and, quote, save democracy, unquote. A contradiction in terms that is fraught with many problems. The other option is for pro-democracy forces to forget about overthrowing President Musharraf for the time being and unite to make the system functional and more democratic step by step. This means coalition building everywhere. The PPP can form a provincial government in Sindh, but may be advised to get the MQM on board in the interests of stability. In the Northwest Frontier Province, too, the ANP and PPP can form a coalition that is secular and moderate. In Balochistan, thanks to the boycott by the nationalists, the PMLQ is in the driving seat. The real issue is what to do in Islamabad and Punjab. In Islamabad, the PPP is the largest party and should be asked by President Musharraf to form a government. It can do so with the PMLQ, the ANP, the MQM, and almost everyone else, except the PMLN, Mr. Sharif's party. This PPP-PMLQ formula would work in the Punjab too, because the provincial independents would naturally gravitate towards a dispensation that supplements the one in Islamabad. But the problem with this approach is that Mr. Zardari would have to establish a working relationship with the unpopular President Musharraf, and thereby risk the ire of many idealistic PPP voters and supporters, including the angry civil society protesters who want Mr. Iftikhar Chaudhry restored as a Chief Justice of Pakistan, which clearly is not possible with President Musharraf around. The other option is for Mr. Zardari to try and include Mr. Sharif's PMLN in coalitions in Islamabad and Punjab and exclude the PMLQ. This would mean two things. First, it would be an anti-Musharraf dispensation that is likely to end up in confrontation mode sooner than later and jeopardize the transition to greater democracy. At any rate, any strategy that leads to the overthrow of President Musharraf will automatically lead to the reunification of the Muslim League under Mr. Sharif and swell its ranks to overwhelm the PPP once again. Second, Mr. Zardari would have to fork over Punjab to Mr. Sharif if he wants to keep Islamabad to himself. But after Mr. Sharif gets Punjab with Mr. Zardari's support, he will be able to corral the independents into his camp. Then Mr. Zardari would be at his mercy in Punjab and therefore in Islamabad. In the event, Mr. Sharif could choose the moment of confrontation with President Musharraf and precipitate a crisis leading to a fresh election in which he, rather than Mr. Zardari, would be the biggest beneficiary. Given the longer-term divergence of party political interests of the two competitor parties, Mr. Zardari must therefore scrutinize this option before succumbing to its emotional national reconciliation rhetoric and pull. At the end of the day, the unpopular but pragmatic dialectic which propelled the PPP to choose the electoral route of transiting to democracy in the presence of President Musharraf instead of a boycott and confrontation preferred by Mr. Sharif will have to be realistically weighed by Mr. Zardari. There will be a time when President Musharraf will definitely be hoist by his own petard, but whether the time has come is not certain from the point of view of party political interests. President Musharraf would certainly hasten it if he continues to throw his weight about, if he manipulates politics via the intelligence agencies like he's done in the past, and if he doesn't zip up about people and personality. Indeed, if the transition to democracy is to succeed in the longer term, Mr. Musharraf will have to retreat to the shadows and eventually bow out to redeem himself and the country. I'm through.
Great. Thank you very much. I don't think you used all your time, but we appreciate that opening. I think it's a good table setter for the coming political challenges. The format we have here is that people can just come up to the microphone and let me know if you have a question or if you'd like to step forward, just raise your hand, and then just speak into the microphone if you have a question. And please identify yourself so the callers know who's talking. Thanks.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association, and I am from India, Indian Army, and ex-aide to the President of India. I would like to know what has been the fate of the militant organizations as well as the fundamentalist Islamist parties. They have been, I think, routed out with this election. And what is the future and the fate with Musharraf? Thank you.
Yes, well, I'll be pretty brief. The religious parties generally have been routed. Half the religious parties boycotted the election. The other half that did contest have been boycotted, have been routed. There are two reasons for this. One, of course, is that there was the incumbency factor. The Mutida Majlis-e-Amal, the five-party alliance that ruled the Northwest Frontier Province, did a very bad job of government. And so that, of course, persuaded the voters to go against them. But more than that, the extremist policies of the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in the Northwest Frontier Province, who were given a lot of breathing space by the Northwest Frontier Province government, have rebounded. The violence that they have perpetrated, principally against the parties that wanted to contest the elections, in which hundreds of innocent people were killed, has rebounded on them. And there is a backlash against the religious party. So I think for both these reasons, the secular nationalist parties and the progressive liberal like the Army National Party have come back with a bang, and the People's Party has also come back with a great showing. So between these two liberal secular parties, they should be able to form a government. So to answer, that's the first part of your question. The second part is this an enduring legacy? Will the fundamentalists come back? Yes. Well, if we are unable to make this transition to a moderate and mainstream democracy, if the elections throw up coalition governments that are unsuccessful, that end up with a lot of infighting and a lot of discrediting, then I fear that when the next elections roll around, democracy and the mainstream parties will have been discredited, and once again there will be a tendency to try and fill that vacuum with the religious parties. And the religious parties will have learned they might have become more moderate by then, and then they will try and woo the population again. So it's very important that in this transition to democracy, the mainstream parties make the system work instead of bungling again and succumbing to corruption and incompetence and inefficiency, and thereby creating a vacuum again.
This is Rick Barton again. A couple of questions. How long do you expect this coalition building process to unfold? And there are seem to be rumors about President Musharraf's making alternate plans. And then finally, what is the PPP position on the rule of law? There seems to be some doubt that they were not as strong on the reinstatement of the judges through the election season.
Yeah. I imagine that before Parliament meets, which could be in the next 30 days or even earlier, in the next 15 days, Mr. Zardari will have to make up his mind about the options he has to choose. If he decides to go with Mr. Sharif, then he will have to get into a confrontation mode, in which case the first confrontation could arise the day Parliament meets. They could turn around and say, we don't accept the oath under which we are being asked to sit in Parliament. This is an oath by a constitution that has been amended by judges who we don't accept, the post-PCO judges. And therefore, that could be the first crisis. If that happens, then they will have to take to the streets and we will get into a full-blown confrontation. Which will eventually end up in an ugly situation where the army may have to intervene to pry apart the warring sides and maybe ask Musharraf to go. And of course, then all sorts of other possibilities will open up. The second question is, how is the PPP going to react to this demand by civil society and the lawyers' movement about the restoration of the Chief Justice of Pakistan? I think this is built in with the first question. If the PPP decides to go into confrontation mode, well, this is an excellent peg on which to start the process. But if the PPP decides to work with President Musharraf, then clearly they will have to find ways and means of, in a sense, abandoning the Chief Justice and getting the other judges back into the judiciary. That may be a compromise that may be amenable to both Parliament and a chastened Musharraf. But you can't expect Musharraf and the former Chief Justice of Pakistan to be both around at the same time.
Hi, sir. This is Peter Popman. I'm with the Netherlands Embassy here in Washington. I got a couple of questions about Pakistani U.S. relations. The news media said, some of the news media said yesterday, that the outcome of these elections was a blow to the Bush administration. Do you share that view? What is the view right now of the victors in this election of the United States? What do they want from the United States? And what would you say should be a sensible U.S. policy at this moment? Thank you.
Well, it's true that this transition to democracy has been midwifed by the international community in general and the United States in particular. And in fact, there was a lot of opposition and hostility to it precisely because of the anti-American sentiment in the country. Ms. Bhutto was at the receiving end of it. She was seen as an American agent or somebody who was allowing the Americans to pull the strings and give General Musharraf a new lease of life. But at the end of the day, the People's Party has pulled it through. People are generally delighted that this is surprisingly this election wasn't as rigged as they thought it might be, and that the results are generally in conformity with the results that the pollsters said would emerge in a free election. So the American influence has ended up being a benign influence, and no one today is saying, "Oh, the Americans did the wrong thing by getting this by pushing for such a transition." So in that sense, the U.S. has done well in terms of ensuring that Musharraf didn't rig the elections and putting pressure on him. The fact that there were three top U.S. senators in Pakistan on the day of the election certainly sent a very strong message to the army and to President Musharraf. Having said that, in terms of U.S. policy, I think the American policy in this region is likely to be more of the same. That is, they are likely to continue to support Musharraf because of his role in the war on terror. But I think now Musharraf will have a political support base behind him in terms of the People's Party, the MQM, and even the ANP, especially in the Northwest Frontier Province. So there will be more and better results all around. I think the U.S. Obsession with getting the government of Pakistan to do more need not be articulated so publicly now, because I dare say that in time to come, all the political forces of the country will probably want to do that. Now that the fundamentalists are on the run, it'll be easier. And now that there will be a more sympathetic government in the frontier to the war on terror, it will be more possible. So I think the U.S. needs to, whatever it needs to say to General Musharraf or to Asif Zardari, it needs to say it in private. U.S. public intervention should be minimal. It tends to raise hackles here in this country. The U.S. needs to keep the pressure on President Musharraf not to be an interventionist president, to let the system work, to take a back seat, and to let the democratic transition unfold.
Sounds like a very delicate balance. So why don't we take two more questions, and then we'll move to the other speakers.
Craig Cohen from CSIS. Sir, how much say do you think Parliament will have in the approach to the militants on the border? And do you think that Parliament will push the Pakistani position toward an approach that favors dialogue in lieu of more aggressive military operations?
I think we're talking about two borders here. I think there is a broad consensus within the People's Party, the Awami National Party, and even now Nawaz Sharif's party, that the peace process with India must continue and that General Musharraf is broadly on the right track. So on that border, I think the process that has been put in cold storage with the crisis in Pakistan will probably begin afresh, and I think that would be a great thing. Secondly, the question of the Afghanistan border and the question of assisting the NATO and ISAF forces in Afghanistan. I think the army will have to play an important role, and the role of General Kiani will be very important. But he's already indicated which way he leans to, and he's all for the war on terror. And I think probably the army will now get a better support base in Parliament. In the old days, every time there was any action in those regions, the strong opposition led by the mullahs, who dominated Parliament, who were like 30% of Parliament was mullah-driven, would create enormous difficulties for the government. Now, since that's not going to be the case, the protests and the opposition to any joint operations by the Americans and the Pakistan Army is going to be minimal. So I rather think that Parliament is supportive of it.
Yes, this is Dana Marshall. The question is on economic policy. Pakistan's very good economic growth has been slowed by a number of factors. I wonder to what extent were economic issues part of the campaign, and maybe even more importantly, How do you expect any coalition that may emerge from this election to be picking up on some of the economic challenges facing the country?
Yes, you're right. Economic issues were a part of the elections. In the run-up to the elections, the question of wheat prices was very important. There were wheat shortages because the government had mismanaged the whole wheat stock. They ended up exporting wheat, so there was a lot of anger on the street. There's a lot of anger on the street about food prices in general. But more than that, in the next month or so, as soon as the new government comes into power, one of the most unpopular decisions that will have to take have to do with fuel prices. The government has held off increasing fuel prices and been given a huge subsidy, but that will have to come to an end because the fiscal deficit is going to be affected by that. And that is going to be a very unpopular decision. So economics is going to matter. The second thing, of course, is that the stock market has responded favorably to the election result, which is a good sign. And if the coalition governments that come into being are able to continue with the policies unfurled by General Musharraf, then I imagine more foreign investment will come into the country. But everything depends on the stability of the governments in Islamabad especially. Government in Islamabad is not stable. If there's wrangling, if there is making and breaking, if there are constant crises, then economic policy will suffer. And this time, economic policy will not be in the hands of a dictator like General Musharraf, who can order things around and be terribly efficient when it comes to decision-making. It will be in the hands of parliament, it will be in the hands of parliamentary committees, and it will be in the hands of civilians who are wont to making decisions that are not always in conformity with the national interests, which have to short-term party political interests. So we will have to wait and see whether the economy responds to a stable government. I think it will, but I'm not sure whether or not the civilians will be able to give the sort of continuity that is needed. That is an open question.
Well, thank you very much. I think it's we really appreciate your joining our call, and we should move on to the other three guests. I know that you have to leave, Nujum, so thank you for joining us, and I will now move on to Ahmed Bilal Mehboob, who will describe some his view of the elections, and thank you again very much.
Thank you.
Are you there, Ahmed?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, please, if you could give us sort of your seven-minute view of life, we have an attentive group here.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to share my views on some of the challenges which Pakistan faces post-election. Probably I will be done before the 7 minutes have run out. The situation Pakistan finds itself in today is quite typical of when an autocratic government, or a government dominated by one person, is trying to make a transition towards a fuller democracy. If there's one common theme about the elections which took place on the 18th of February, that is that it's an overwhelmingly a vote against the policies and all what General Pervez Musharraf stood for, at least for most of the things which it did in the last 1 year or so, that has been a resounding vote against that. Now, with that situation which we find ourselves in, and people having spoken against the policies, and they could have voted for Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, they might have voted for Pakistan People's Party, they might have voted for Awami National Party, but common theme and strand is that they have very clearly and very strongly given their verdict about the policies which General Musharraf had been following, especially in the context of rule of law in the country. Now, faced with this clear verdict of the people, now the question is how various political parties like Pakistan People's Party or Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz can chart out their policy in defiance to that verdict. So that's the greatest challenge which Pakistan faces today, that how does it transit from here to a fuller democracy with a president whose policies have been solidly rejected. And if you look at it, this finds its root in the way election of president was designed under a constitutional amendment, which was brought in again and designed by General Pervez Musharraf when he took over the government in 1999. At that time, the constitution provided the election of the president after the election of the National Assembly which means a president will then reflect the popular will of the people as it comes through the assembly. But that provision was changed, and president was made to be elected before the parliament. Therefore, now we are in a situation where we have, on the one side, the parliament, which stands for certain things, which has been elected on certain commitments and pledges. And we, on the other hand, we have a president whose policies have been so openly and so clearly rejected by the people. So I think the first and foremost challenge is that of the Constitution, which is in the form of a rule of law as well, because Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz is very openly committed to the restoration of the judges who were deposed after the action of 3rd of November when he declared emergency, and one may even call it a de facto martial law. Now, if the judges are not restored and there is no practical way of finding the restoration of judges, then I think the will of the people and the verdict of the people will remain incomplete. So this is the situation in which we are in. And as my colleague, Mr. Najam Sethi, has already said, the problem is there is a Senate which is dominated by Pakistan Muslim League Q, which is now a minority party in the National Assembly. Any constitutional amendment will have to go through the Senate, where the current dispensation, which may come into play after the government is formed, may not be able to get through any constitutional amendment in that case. So in this situation, there is a view that whichever government is formed in the next 1 month or so can restore the judges by a mere executive order. If that is the case, and that interpretation holds good, that is also leading a way towards political instability, because that is where you will be having two executive authorities pitted against each other. On the one side will be Prime Minister, and the other side will be the President. And again, basically, the decision will be again sooner or later referred to the military, which is again something in contradiction with the will of the people, who want military totally out of the political arena and want to decide things within the parliament. So we are faced with a crisis-like situation, and this is something which will demand a high level of maturity on the part of the political parties. So something which looks very strange at this time, and which might be something which is unthinkable, but I think finally political parties will have to sit together, and Pakistan People's Party, Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, and Pakistan Muslim League Q, all three of them, along with some of the other parties which are in smaller numbers represented in the parliament, will have to sit together and find a way out. Until these political parties display the maturity to talk to each other and come to some kind of a solution, this political impasse or for this crisis may even intensify, and that will lead to instability in Pakistan. So I think this is a test of the maturity of political parties who may be very bitterly against each other, who might have been bitter rivals in the recent past, but there is no way except sitting together and finding a way out. The second point which I wish to make is about the religious extremism. I think Mr. Najam Sethi has already dwelt on this, and quite a few questions which have been raised about the outcome of the election in the context of the rout of Mutahida Majlis-e Amal, or the religious political parties. I wish to just convey my view that when in 2002 MMA was elected, it was wrong to interpret that victory as a vote for Islamic fundamentalism. It was wrong to think that people have voted for establishing a strict Islamic political system in the country. I think even then, it was a vote through which people were expressing the need for change. The people were protesting against some of the things which were happening at that time. And that was against, again, a kind of a protest against the policies of General Musharraf at that time. So that should not be read into as something which was in favor of bringing in an extremist form of religious government in Pakistan. And today, when the religious parties have been reduced in number in the parliament and in the provincial assemblies One should not try to interpret it as the defeat of religious sentiment in Pakistan or the victory of secularism or secular parties in Pakistan. I think it should be simply interpreted as a people's vote for change. People want good governance. People want rule of law. And they have expressed through this vote because they found the rule of law and the good governance missing in the case of NMA government in the Northwest Frontier Province. And by NMA, at least that part of NMA, which has participated in election, they were ambivalent about General Musharraf. They were not very clearly taking a position against General Pervez Musharraf. So I think they have been punished for not being sufficiently clear about the policies of General Pervez Musharraf. And General Maulana Fazlur Rahman, head of the MMA, or head of the Jamiat Ulama Islam Fazlur Rahman group, has been personally punished also in the form of defeat in one of the constituencies because he tried to be closer to the policies of General Pervez Musharraf than compared to other parties within the coalition. So therefore, it is not a vote against the religious parties in the context, but it should be interpreted as a vote for good governance, for vote for the rule of law. So those parties who identified themselves with the policies which went against rule of law have been punished. And those parties who have been championing the cause of rule of law, including the restoration of the judges, have been rewarded by giving them a vote of confidence in the elections which we have seen on the 18th of February. Now, I think another important challenge which Pakistan faces is in the form of sovereignty of the parliament. I think over the past 8 years, the laws which have been passed, the constitutional amendments which have been brought, and the conduct which has been allowed to go on in Pakistan has basically reduced parliament to an ineffective institution. So I think the challenge before the next government, after dealing with the challenges which are immediate in the context of constitution, in the context of judiciary, I think the major challenge before them will be the challenge of strengthening the parliament, giving its due place and involving it into the major decision-making and allowing it to the role of an oversight body on the policies of the executive, which had been quite minimal. It started to take off and the parliamentary committee started to work effectively in the later part of the parliament, but that is something which needs to be taken forward. So I think in the days to come, it is a challenge basically for the political parties also, because political parties over the last 8 years have been basically advocating against Pervez Musharraf and have been playing on the sentiments which are against Pervez Musharraf, but they have not focused so much on their own reorganization, on their own democratization. So they now will be a center of focus increasingly in Pakistan, and their own conduct will be watched. They will not be just watched in the context or in contrast to what policies they have to General Musharraf, but they will also be watched how much democracy they bring in within their own parties and how much organization do they bring in to strengthen the parliament and strengthen the political parties. I was struck by the statement of Mr. Nawaz Sharif during the press conference that not even once did he mention that he will be consulting his own political party before taking a position on the coalition making or on dealing with Pakistan People's Party. And so has been the case with most of the political parties. So I think people of Pakistan, now the elections are out of the way, will also be watching how political parties conduct themselves and how do they really, what they have been paying lip service, or they have been verbally advocating, how far they will implement and how far their conduct will be different in the days to come from the conduct when they were holding power in Pakistan, both by Pakistan People's Party and Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz. So I think these are some of the challenges which Pakistan is going to face, and which, again, I will repeat, basically it is the maturity It is the political will of the political parties which will hopefully see us through this crisis, which we are about to face, which we are going through. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much for your helpful overview. You've left a lot of questions on the table that we will come back to after our next two speakers, in particular regarding the maturation process of the political system in Pakistan. And thank you. So we will come back to you if you can stay online. Now we'd like to turn to Glenn Cowan, who has been leading an observer delegation that was commissioned by the United States government of 39 observers, and they've been there the last few days. Glenn, please give us your view, either the parallel vote count or whatever you feel is most timely at this point.
The U.S. observer delegation has within the last hour just held its press conference to release its preliminary assessment of the elections. I want to speak a little bit to what the observers saw and something of the context within which these elections were held. Election day itself turned out to be much better than was anticipated. There were extraordinary concerns about violence on election day, and the turnout, as high as it may have been, which has been projected to be someplace between perhaps high 30s and mid 40s percentage, which is a good turnout in terms of Pakistan's history. But nevertheless, that turnout could have been and would have been much better other than for the atmosphere of fear created by so much violence leading up to the election. The environment in which this election was held was anything but democratic. You had had an administration which had declared emergency rule, which had effectively sacked the entire hierarchy of the judiciary, replaced them with more compliant judges, had suppressed freedom of the press, had arrested hundreds if not thousands of civic activists and political party adherents, had sent into exile the two leaders of two of the principal parties, had not prevented the amount of violence that was visited against the political parties, culminating, of course, in the assassination of former Prime Minister Bhutto. None of this provided an environment in which one could expect an open and free election. The amount of pre-poll rigging, as it is called here, which was presumed by most of the electorate, probably was not realized, and I'll talk in a moment as to why that might have been the case. Nevertheless, there are a series of systemic problems that this country faces, and I do not think that moving forward, the international community particularly should presume that luck is a lesson learned. If the government of Pakistan, the newly installed government coming from this new National Assembly and from the provincial assemblies, not address some of the underlying issues that face Pakistan, we will find ourselves in the next election cycle facing precisely the same kinds of problems. I'm not going to speak to some of the systemic electoral problems because Stefan has been here throughout the period of assistance to the Elections Commission of Pakistan, is much better prepared to speak to those issues. But just quickly, there are complaints about the registration process, complaints about the availability of the computerized national identity card, the complaints about the independence of the Elections Commission of Pakistan. And these all need to be dealt with as we move forward. Speaking as an individual, not as the director of the International Election Observer Group from the United States, I also think that the political parties are not, it was mentioned just earlier that they have to begin to look at their own internal structures, their own internal policies. The fact is, these are not democratic political organizations. They are leader-centric. They are based on the power of personalities. They basically come from the landed class. They come from the landlord class. These are autocratic organizations. They don't represent constituencies in any democratic way. The idea that these parties, as was mentioned, would begin to make these judgments about who they are going to I am absolutely certain that these discussions are being made without a scintilla of thought to whether or not those folks who came out in the face of a really daunting security situation and voted for them, there's just no thought whatever to the people of this country on the part of those political parties. They will argue differently. They will say they represent their constituents. But if you look at comments about those political parties written by analysts in 1992 and 94 and 98 and 2000 and 2004 and just a month ago, you will find the descriptions are virtually identical, that these are leader-centric, top-down, undemocratic, internally autocratic organizations that do not represent the actual of their adherents. And unless the political parties become a vibrant political, democratic political force in the next years, Pakistan will continue to suffer from many of the same problems that it has faced. This is a very, very poor country, 160 million people, many of whom live in near poverty, if not in absolute poverty. The illiteracy rate here is one of the highest in the world. The way in which women are permitted to participate in the society is very limited. And you can't have a thriving democracy under those circumstances. My own concern is that the parties will now go along to get along in order to take power, in order to avail themselves of the extraordinary patronage that comes with holding political power here, and they will continue along the course that they have pursued for the last 20 years. That would be unfortunate because this is, in fact, a potentially historic opportunity for something moving towards real democracy to take place here. But it will require the political parties to do it. Civil society, particularly organized civil society, can play a role, of course, but it is going to rely on the parties to look to their own self-interest from the perspective of their own constituents, which at this point, in my own view, they don't do.
Glenn, thank you very much. I think you've taken a very clear position and one that really reinforces the prior speaker's concern about the maturing process of the parties. We'll come back to that. Stefan, if you are still there, we'd like to have you go next.
Thank you very much, Rick. As Glenn mentioned, there's been less than a handful of ISIS advisors working with the Election Commission of Pakistan for the last 16 months. So I will not take the bird's view. I will be more looking at the election day, what happens there, and then focus on what needs to happen next. So let's start with the election day. I would say because of the outcome of these elections, I fear that the enormous need for electoral reform here in Pakistan will be ignored. I would say that in spite of the many breaches of fundamental democratic rights, violation of international standards, and lack of best practices, it seems like these elections will be acceptable to the Pakistani stakeholders. I'm actually really pleased about the parties accepting the election results, but I'm equally concerned that we will ignore all the impediments existing in the Pakistani electoral process, preventing us from actually organizing decent elections in the future. All the significant problems with the pre-election process are well known, and Glenn mentioned some of them. So I will focus my introductory remarks to the election day and the count. The election day came to a slow start in several parts of the country, as more than 20% of the polling stations opened late. In Balochistan and NWFP, every third polling station opened late. Female polling stations in particular were affected by the late opening, but also poorly trained staff often manned these stations, and in some cases, female polling stations didn't open at all. The new election commodities procured for these elections, such as the translucent ballot boxes, security seals, and voting compartments, were all used and used properly in most instances. The voter register seems to largely have held water, in spite of it not being as accurate and as complete as we wanted it to be. But many of the polling stations were poorly managed, causing confusions and a sluggish voting process. I've seen reports of people leaving the queue before casting their votes. Unfortunately, the election results process displayed the serious flaws that we had feared. True, the counting of the ballot papers in the polling stations worked reasonably well, although domestic observers were prevented from being present during the count in 10% of the polling stations. Of even more concern is the fact that the tallying of results by returning officers was not done in a transparent manner. Following the counting of ballots in a polling station, the result sheets are brought to the office of a returning officer who's in charge of tallying the results in his constituency. A constituency is usually made up of about 250 polling stations. In fact, as of today, we have no way of knowing if the results being announced by the Election Commission are actually a true reflection of the will of the people, as the results were in many cases tallied behind closed doors. Even international observers from the EU were denied access to the tallying of the results in more than 15% of the cases. The chief observer of the EU Observation Mission himself was denied access to the returning officer, even here in Islamabad. Naturally, such actions are not only a violation of ECP's own code of conduct and procedures, but more importantly, it breeds suspicion of manipulation of the results. ECP centrally is yet to commit publicly to releasing results polling station by polling station and not just as a lump sum of votes received by the candidates. Only if results are made available on a polling station basis can we actually verify the results. And as the celebrations of the last days come to an end, we will notice that we have disgruntled candidates on our hands that want to challenge these results. And I'm not only talking about representatives of the former government, but also PPP and PMLN candidates. The reasons are threefold. Firstly, because in a significant number of races, the margin of victory is relatively small. Secondly, the dubious result system that I just talked about breeds petitions. And thirdly, problems of irregularities on election day. So the work of the election tribunals will be key for the post-election phase. And have a look at these election tribunals. On paper, this election tribunal system in Pakistan seems to be a good dispute resolution mechanism. The tribunals are run by experienced high court judges. Petitions need to be filed within 45 days of certified election results and must be disposed of within 120 days of these tribunals. The reality is very different, though. It is true that the judges are experienced, but they all had to take the oath under provisional constitutional order and is therefore perceived as being politicized. Equally important, as the judges are still tasked to perform the regular court duties, they're incapable of disposing of many cases within the stipulated 120-day limit, therefore undermining a fundamental legal recourse mechanism. As part of our programs out here, ICES is running an election tribunal monitoring project involving Pakistani lawyers who will follow the work of these tribunals in all four provinces over the next 6 months, and will for this time be able to come up with detailed findings and recommendations as how the work of the tribunals can improve in time for the next election. So I feel that I'm a bit of a spoiler here, since people are so focused on what's going to happen next and accepting these results at a face value. I think we need to step back and still revisit what happened on election day and also closely monitor the work of the aggregation of the results. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you all of you for being extremely informative and concise. So now we will move to the question period. And again, please let me know if you are ready to step up. Why don't I start with the first question while people are getting warmed up again? Just to let the guests know that both in Pakistan and here, that we have captured what a number of bloggers have been reporting as well, and we've passed out their reports somewhat edited here for our guests, but it will also be on our blog so that you can get a little better sense from the field what people are thinking. One question that was left for me by Stephen Lennon, who works with USAID and has spent quite a bit of time in the Northwest Frontier Province trying to develop a development program that might help with that area. He was asking if the independent parties in the NWFP, who are they leaning towards, and where are they likely to settle in any coalition? And then since each of you have really spoken to the maturity or the maturing or the need for the rapid maturation of both the political parties and the political system, maybe you could suggest one step that could be taken that would be a step in the right direction, an initial step in the right direction that would confirm that there is the political will that each of you seems to be somewhat worried about. So a specific question about the NWFP from a guest who's left, and then the broader question. Please feel free. Who would like to go? Maybe Ahmed on the question about the NWFP. Does that make sense for you?
I think the leading party in NWFP, which has emerged in these elections, is Awami National Party, or ANP. And before the elections, they were part of a coalition with the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, which is Nawaz Sharif's party, PMLN. And they were part of what is called All Parties Democratic Movement. So that party has already been a part of that coalition or an alliance which was formed before the elections. So I would see, and ANP had been had the experience of working with PMLN in the past when they have been part of a kind of a coalition, because some of these members were part of the coalition at the center with the Nawaz Sharif. So I think the most likely scenario that they will go along with PMLN, but at the same time, they have a lot in common with Pakistan People's Party as well. So I think it is going to be finally the kind of terms which are offered to them by the lead partner, which will make a decision. Otherwise, I think the ANP feels perfectly comfortable both with Nawaz Sharif and with Pakistan People's Party, and could go with either one of them.
I may have also misphrased the question a little bit, because I think Stephen was equally interested in the independents. We're looking at an election result map here on our wall, which shows a tremendous number of independent candidates, in particular in North and South Waziristan. Wonder, are they likely to be sympathetic to the ANP, or are they wildly independent? Are they all over the place?
No, these people coming from the tribal areas, since Pakistan's political party's law does not extend into the tribal areas, so they, in spite of the fact they have definite political affiliations, they cannot be formally identified with any one political party. But they are part of political parties, so political party law and the defection law also does not apply to them. My sense is, looking at the people who were elected as independents, that almost 50% of them will be able to side with the Awami National Party, ANP, and other 50% are sympathetic to MMA. So this is the kind of rough division, I would say, that ANP, PML, this kind of parties, 50% of them will support, another 50% will go along with MMA. And on a case-to-case basis, they will also change their stance, because, again, the law does not apply to them, by which they are discipline-bound to vote with any one political party.
Excellent. Now, maybe each of you could take on this question of an important first step in the maturation of the political parties or system.
I don't think the political parties, and again, I'm speaking as an individual, I do not think the political parties will reform themselves. There will not be another election here, barring unforeseen circumstances, for quite some years. There will be some number of by-elections. It will require an active civil society and an organized non-governmental organization movement to create a demand side to move the political parties. And one of the positive outcomes of the unfortunate lack of democracy that we've seen during the period of state of emergency was the emergence of civil society, not organized non-governmental society, but civil society, particularly as evidenced by the lawyers' movement. But as you get around the country, and I spent 3 weeks here in December speaking precisely to the political parties and others who are engaged in the business of how political parties engage with their citizens, the political parties don't have demands placed on them from the bottom up. And civil society, as organized in the non-governmental organizations, has generally not placed those demands either. So the lawyers' movement and, to a lesser degree, union movements, teachers' movements, some civil service movements possibly might represent an opportunity to begin to demand of the political parties that they begin to think about the policies that they bring out during campaigns and then immediately forget about once election day has passed. The parties are not going to do it on their own. They're going to have to have it. They're going to have their internal control dragged away from them by demand from the bottom up. Now, having said that, that is an extraordinarily difficult set of. It's going to be really hard for civil society to do that. They don't have the resources for it. They don't have the power at their command. And I think this will have to start first from the lawyers and then spread from there if we're really going to get any kind of response from the political parties other than the token bow to their own constituents.
Thank you, Stefan. How about you?
This is Stefan Dornal. Since we've been working with ECP, and it is the main vehicle for a lot of things when it comes to the electoral process, I would say that it's a huge distrust against ECP amongst the political parties. And a strong signal and a very good indicator that there is a willingness for reform, and that would be sort of seen as the first step towards something of an improvement and a maturity, would be how you point the leadership of the election commission. It needs to be dealing from the presidency, and you have to have a more consultative process involving political parties as well as the civil society when you're appointing the chief election commissioner and also the commissioners. I think this will not only send a strong signal to the political parties, but it will send an equally strong signal internally within the ECP and shake it up. So I would see that as a very, very significant decision. It's something, if this was brought onto the reform agenda in the next coming months.
Ahmed, how about you?
Can I add something to this?
Please.
In my view, the political parties, there are two aspects of political parties we are discussing. One is the internal democratization of the parties, and secondly, maturing of the political parties, and essentially these may be two complementing each other, maybe the same thing. I think the first thing is that the political process in the country should be allowed to go ahead unhindered, uninterrupted by the forces which are not supposed to be participating in the political process. I mean to say the military had been interrupting the political process at regular intervals in Pakistan, and that stalls the political process. So I think if the political process is allowed to continue, it has a self-correcting and self-improving mechanism which will bring in more democracy and more maturity to political parties. That is one. And second thing is, and I think the way civil society had been looking at some of the aspects of democracy in the past and during this election, I think those institutions, think tanks, are civil society organizations which are specifically looking at the performance of the parliament and performance of the various political parties in the parliament, I think they need to be strengthened, their capacity needs to be built, so that these parties, these civil society organizations get into serious research about the performance of these parties, about the conduct of these parties, and especially how they perform within the parliament. So I think if the people are looking at their performance and the media is projecting good things and the bad things which political parties are indulging in, I think this will, with the passage of time, help political parties to democratize and mature. Thank you.
There was a period early in the Musharraf presidency where he was something of a reformer, and obviously the expansion of civil society and the opening of the media were two elements of it. What would happen if President Musharraf fell back into a benign ombudsman role, and so that he was no longer the punching bag or the excuse or the scapegoat for for everyone else in the political process? What would that do to the political mix in Pakistan?
Your question is about General Musharraf converting himself to an ombudsman?
To a more benign ombudsman and overseer of the political process rather than the dominant force that he's been over the last 10 years.
My view is that General Musharraf, by temperament, is someone of an activist. He has to be in a role which demands a lot of activity. He has to be in control. He has to be the main person driving the operations. I cannot imagine him to be in a position where he can be just an observer or a silent observer. So he will either be in control or trying to be fully in control, or he may not be there. So I do not think General Pervez Musharraf fits into that position of an ombudsman, and especially because he is primarily trained as a general. And he has, despite the fact he had been in a political role for the last 8 years, still he is not someone who understands, who is comfortable with, who is at peace with the political process and the way politics is conducted. So I do not think he's a person who is suited for that kind of a role.
Hey, Rick, this is Glenn Cowan. I have some official duties as the leader, the director of the U.S. Observer Delegation that I'm going to have to get to. Thanks for the opportunity. Hopefully, when I return to Washington, we can sit down and discuss some of these issues more thoroughly. I am going to have to get off the line now.
Great. Thanks very much, Glenn. What we have is it looks like we have a couple more questions here for our other guests. And, Glenn, by leaving early, you won't get the ovation that we'll give the others.
I'm perfectly delighted to share with my august guest host.
All right. We have a couple of questions. Thanks, couple of questions here that will go.
My name is Jemina Siddiqui. I'm from the Henry L. Stimson Center. There are reports that women were not allowed to participate in the election process in NWFP. Can you please comment on how widespread this was, and were there election observers in those areas, and how many?
When it comes to female participation in NWFP, yes, there's a significant number of reports identifying that they were in fact denied. There were decisions taken by tribal elders to prevent women from taking part in it. The participation from the international community was extremely limited in NWFP, and especially in non-existing in the tribal areas. We had to rely on the Baffin Domestic Observers, and even then they had some problems out there. So it's difficult at this stage to quantify the extent of the problem. What I would say is critical, though, is to see if these results will be certified or not. What are the decisions that will come out of this? Will we have a recall in these, or will they be allowed to stand? I think that's an important issue to follow.
I think this issue or the problem of denial of voting to the women in NWFP and some of the other areas as well is limited to two or three districts. I think it is not a widespread problem, fortunately, but still it doesn't take away the gravity of the problem. I think we need to have a legislation by which in an area where an evidence is found that the women have been denied and there have been some kind of an agreement among various political parties to deny them the right to vote, I think the Election Commission should declare that election void. Until that is done, I do not think a real headway will be made. But in parallel, I think the The women organizations, the civil society organizations need to raise the level of awareness among the people to overcome that cultural taboo which leads them to do these kind of things that denying women the right to vote. But at the same time, we need to improve the polling stations, their environment, providing some physical infrastructure like toilets, and providing them a fully women, ladies staff who can cater to the women voters. I think that will encourage women voters to come forward and vote in such areas.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have a bit of a pattern here. We had violation last year in some of the FASAs, and the Election Commission did certify the results, even though it was informed that not a single female voter was allowed to participate. So that was extremely unfortunate. I totally agree with Vilagzab's recommendation that there should be a legal code for preventing results of these being certified.
We have one last question, and then I think that this would be it, if, or maybe two questions. Why don't we get the two questions on the table and then let you answer both of them. So let's ask both of them before they go.
Colonel Dutta, Foreign Policy Association again. Briefly, talking of the ground realities after elections, for the last 36 years or so, Army has been coming in to rule on the reasons of rescuing the country from the civilian government's corruption. In that process, it got embedded in every aspect of national life by now. How would the new government would like to eradicate, and the new government would may emerge from the same known corrupt civilian politicians and the leaders, will eradicate this army influence and yet fight the terrorism inside and outside. And I'm sure U.S. will be seriously concerned in this region, which is getting unstable day by day.
Vanessa Kulik, PCR Project, CSIS. I was wondering how much power, how likely it is that the Senate would veto or go against the reinstatement of the judges, considering that the vote was seen as a referendum on the current policies, and it was very negative. So I was wondering if maybe in light of trying to appease the people of Pakistan, that there, how likely it is that they would say and compromise to get back the rule of law. Thank you.
Well, when it comes to the Senate, I think this falls back to what Glenn said and also Bilal Saab said earlier, and that's the weakness of the political parties. So there's a huge chance or risk, depending on which political side you're on, that these senators will actually listen to the groundswell that we saw on February 18th and maybe in favor of this, because we have to realize that the Q party is a new, fairly newly established party, and its main leader and the ones they all benefited from is increasingly becoming weaker and weaker by the day. So I wouldn't be very surprised if we actually have the senator and the Senate voting in favor of whatever the National Assembly decides to go with.
Ahmed, if you're there for the first question, maybe you could address that. The role of the military. Are you still there?
Yeah. Again, I'm experiencing some problem with the voice. I had to. I just joined in between. I have missed out the conversation, so probably I'll be able to comment on the next question, or if you can just concisely tell me what is the question about, and I can attempt to answer that.
Sure. Well, this will be the last question. I think I can reframe. Let me try to frame it for our questioner, and that is. The military over the past decades, since it has been involved in the governments, has taken an increasing role in all forms of society, business, government, education. And how do you see that these parties in this election addressing that phenomena, and will it be addressed?
This is about military.
Yes, about the military's role in the government.
Yeah.
And in society and in business.
Fortunately, I think the military itself has realized that the kind of role which it had been pursuing for a long time, but specifically during the past
8 years has really brought a lot of discredit to this fine institution in Pakistan. And I think this is reflecting in some of the actions with the new chief of army staff has taken, which is by withdrawing people from active military people, withdrawing them from the civilian institutions, stopping some of the things which military was trying to expand beyond their own professional sphere. So that is something very positive. And we have a group of former generals, which is basically a dialogue group on civil-military relations. And what we get the sense from that dialogue is there's an increasing awareness. So I think once awareness about the negative impact of military involving into negative for the military itself of getting involved in areas which are beyond their professional duties. So I think if democracy is restored, I think military itself would be cooperating with that democratic government for not pushing ahead their role in areas which is not their legitimate domain.
This is Stefan. I would also add one thing. It's extremely important to monitor and see what kind of action with any form of teeth that the new government takes when it comes to anti-corruption. It's a systemic endemic problem in the Pakistan society, something the military has very well been exposed to now over the last 8, 9 years. So our organization itself has been seriously compromised by being so closely interwoven into the government of Pakistan. So if the new government, when it's being established, if it just keep on focus on sharing the spoils amongst themselves, then I'm afraid that cleansing the new regime from the military or any anti-corrupt element will be extremely, extremely limited, unfortunately, and that will be a huge detriment for this reestablishing of democracy and setting sail to a better transition here in Pakistan.
Thank you. Thank you very much for this lively hour's discussion. We've greatly appreciated you've had a representation here on this end of student scholars, of representatives of embassies, of people from the U.S. government, the press. So it's been a very rich mix. A number of other people have been on the phone. It's really our intent and our commitment to try to bring the voice of Pakistan and what is happening there into Washington and the United States on a much broader basis and a much more timely basis. And you have been of huge assistance in doing that. We'll look forward to a continuing dialogue with you. And on behalf, I'm going to ask the guests here to thank you with a round of applause. Thank you.